the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Monday said that there was a technical failure after an Israeli strike that local health officials say killed at least 45 Palestinians in the southern Gaza city of Rafah late Sunday. VOA's Jeff Custer.
Speaking at the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, Monday, Netanyahu said Israel is investigating the strike. The reports say started a massive fire that also injured dozens. Netanyahu said Israel had evacuated about a million non-involved civilians before what he called a tragic mistake. Israel has seen surging criticism of its war against Hamas, even from its strongest allies. Speaking following a meeting of the European Union foreign ministers in Geneva Monday, EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell denounced the attack and said the UN's top court order for a ceasefire should be respected.
I condemn this in the stronger terms, and these attacks take place immediately after the International Court of Justice ordered it to stop all military activities in Gaza.
Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Meanwhile, hundreds marched in Tunis on Monday, condemning the Israeli strike on Rafah, which, according to Gaza authorities, killed 45 Palestinians and wounded dozens. Protesters waved Palestinian flags and chanted slogans as they gathered outside the French embassy in the capital. The attack on the tent camp prompted an outcry from global leaders who urged the implementation of a world court order to halt Israel's assault. A report by the United Nations nuclear watchdog says that Iran has further increased its stockpile of uranium enriched to near weapons-grade levels. Confidential report seen by the Associated Press on Monday says Iran now has 142.1 kilograms or about 313.2 pounds of uranium enriched up to 60%, an increase since the previous report in February. This is VOA News. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports on Ukraine's appeal for air defense systems in its war with Russia.
Volodymyr Zelensky has secured from Spain a pledge of additional air defense missiles to help in its fight against Russia. Zelensky says Russia launches about 3,000 bombs every month at Ukraine in the third year of the war. Ukraine still urgently needs another seven U.S.-made Patriot air defense systems to stop Russia from hitting key targets. Weekend Russian aerial bombs hit a construction supply store and a mall in the city of Kharkiv, causing extensive damage and blazes that had to be battled. There were dozens of casualties and injuries. I'm Norman Hall.
North Korea says its attempt to put another spy satellite into orbit has failed. State media said the rocket carrying the satellite exploded after liftoff Monday evening due to a suspected engine problem. The failed launch came hours after leaders of South Korea, China, and Japan met in Seoul in their first trilateral meeting in more than 4 years. It's highly unusual for North Korea to take provocative action when its major ally, China, is engaged in high-level diplomacy in the region. The Papua New Guinea government said more than 2,000 people are believed to have been buried alive in a landslide in the South Pacific island nation. The disaster struck after the side of a mountain came down early Friday morning when the village was asleep. The settlement is a restive and remote area to the interior of the poor rural nation off the northern east coast of Australia, making search and rescue efforts complicated and hazardous. The scale of the disaster, local feuds, and the lack of heavy equipment are also factors. AP correspondent Lisa Dwyer reports on Canadian evacuees heading home after wildfire evacuation orders end.
Residents in the western Canadian city of Fort Nelson, British Columbia, were given permission to return home after more than 4,700 people were evacuated for more than 2 weeks due to wildfires. They were forced to leave their homes on May 10th when strong winds pushed the Parker Lake wildfire within a few miles of the town. The wildfire service says that rain over the weekend helped firefighters and that the 47-square-mile fire was not expected to grow. The blaze has not been extinguished, however, and the service says it expects parts of the fire to continue burning into the fall. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
A series of powerful storms in the central and southern U.S. over the Memorial Day holiday weekend killed at least 22 people as they left a wide trail of destroyed homes, businesses, and power outages. The destructive storms caused deaths in the states of Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Kentucky, and were just north of an oppressive early season heat wave, setting records from South Texas to Florida. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
America. I'm James Martin, Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South African voters voice their expectations as early voting begins for Wednesday's presidential elections.
The first thing is electricity. The poverty in the locations, our children must work, and the better education, even the health. If you come to South Africa, come with right papers.
We'll tell you the results of Afrobarometer's latest survey of South African voters. Zambian police say they have found a missing independent member of parliament. UN agencies warn of the deteriorating humanitarian situation for an estimated 800,000 people in South Sudan's Darfur region. Thomas Sankara's brother says that Burkina Faso is not ready for elections in the current environment.
First indisputable point is that the situation is such that we cannot talk about elections in this time. This is something that political parties, most of them, if not all of them, they would agree with that point.
And Biden and Trump campaign for black votes. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Special voting for South Africa's national and provisional elections began yesterday, Monday. The South African Mail and Guardian newspaper quotes the country's electoral commission as saying the process got off to a good start. Meanwhile, Afrobarometer, the Pan-African Research Network, has just published its latest pre-election survey of South African voters. Jan Hofmeyer is the head of research and policy at the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation, the Southern African core partner of Afrobarometer. He tells me that voters want the next government to address unemployment, the unreliable electricity supply, and corruption.
I would say for me, the biggest set of findings relate to the priorities of voters, and that is the problems that people regard as the most important issues affecting their lives. And there's also the issues that will really determine how they will vote or who they will vote for during the election. And those are first and foremost unemployment. As you probably know, South Africa has got a very high unemployment figure, a third of its working age population. And then, of course, there are the questions around energy provision, because we've had these rolling blackouts because our energy grid cannot really cope with the demand anymore due to long-term underinvestment in the system. And then, of course, the third is corruption.
Did you find out, for example, which party or parties are likely to benefit from this seeming dissatisfaction that the voters are telling you?
So I think, and this is the critical thing, we've asked the respondents in the survey, if there was an election tomorrow, which party would you vote for? And an interesting result for us is that about a third of respondents who have indicated that they are registered to vote and that they are likely to vote indicated that they do not know yet which party they will vote for. Now, your next question might be, what are those voters sort of likely to vote? Who would they lean towards? And what we have seen is that close to about 50% of voters have indicated that they do not feel close or partisan towards any political party in South Africa. And we have seen that levels of party affinity decline over the past 15 years. And what that means is that political parties can no longer just rely on the blind loyalty of ordinary South Africans to vote for them. No longer an emotive issue, it is an issue-based vote. That is particularly very prominent among young voters, who are far more discerning than older South Africans in terms of whether they are going to vote, and secondly, which party they will vote for.
So, Jan, how big or large was your survey pool? And I'm interested in knowing, how did you collect the information? Did you interview the respondents directly?
Yes, so it was a telephonic survey of 1,800 South Africans whose telephone numbers were drawn from a database of about 14 million phone numbers. South Africa's population is about 16 million. We got the sample as representative in terms of the different population groups, in terms of gender, in terms of the rural-urban breakdown, and so forth. So we were confident of the accuracy of our sample.
Jan Hofmeyer and policy at the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation, the Southern African Core partner of Afrobarometer. He was speaking with me from Cape Town. VOA's Tuso Kumalo spoke with some South Africans about their expectations for the next government.
The first thing is electricity. Poverty in the locations, our children must work, and the better education, even the health. All these people that are from outside, the Department of Home Affairs must make some plans. If you come to South Africa, come with right papers.
We need change. We cannot live like this as black people. Other people are living in poverty. Others are living in mansions. I mean, it's not fair. We need to change the economy of the country. We must be on in the same level. We don't want this thing of people being poor. That's why we have a lot of high statistics of crime.
The biggest issue for me is crime, if our government can deal with crime, but also issues of education. We need to ensure that our youth go to school, and we need to ensure those that graduate have opportunities, for employment, but also entrepreneurship, I think, is the way to go.
Unemployment. A lot of people doesn't work in our places, so we've got to have jobs. So some of us, we need jobs, something like that we can afford for our pockets and our families. That we can provide for them.
That was a sample of the expectations of some South African voters as their country votes tomorrow, Wednesday, in national and provisional elections. Zambian police say they have found missing independent member of parliament Jay Banda. The MP went missing on Saturday, May 25th, when his abandoned vehicle was discovered and reported to police. Some social media accounts described the missing PM as a critic of President Hakainde Hichilema and his government, and suspect foul play, although speculate that the MP might have faked his own abduction. Home Affairs Minister Jack Mwimbi said Sunday that the government had no hand in the MP's disappearance. Police spokesman Ray Hamuga tells me that MP Banda was discovered Monday lying on the kitchen doorstep of a farmhouse with bruises on his back. He had since been moved from a private health facility to a military hospital.
It happened yesterday around 23 hours when one of our officers that was on duty received a report from a concerned member of the public that there was a person who was claiming to be Honorable Jay Banda, and that he was in an area in Kafue at Kasanga Family Farm. And then our officers quickly rushed there to go and check. And upon arrival, our officers were joined actually by family members who also arrived in three different motor vehicles. These relatives were guided by a resident of the farm, and the family members really identified the individual as the missing Honorable Jay Banda.
What was his condition when you found him?
Okay, he was found lying on the kitchen doorstep of the farmhouse, and he claimed to have been dumped by unknown persons a few meters from the farm. And of course, he did complain of general body pains, and he had bruises were observed on his back.
You mentioned in your release about a disagreement between MP Banda's family and the police, but you were finally able to, take him to the hospital?
Yes, in fact, after discovering him there, the police, along with the family members, they promptly rushed the Honorable Jay Banda to Kafue General Hospital for initial medical care. And at the hospital, that's where a disagreement arose between the relatives of Honorable Jay Banda and the police. The relatives were insisting on transferring him to Midlands Hospital, while the police preferred that he be taken to Mainasoko Medical Center to ensure a comprehensive medical evaluation under secure conditions. And of course, later on, the matter was resolved. Of course, police had to use all legal means at their disposal when they go to Melbourne. Because after that disagreement, the relatives to Jay Banda actually, unfortunately, drove off with him to Midlands Hospital. But our officers were able to trail that vehicle until they reached there, where we tried to reason with them. Again, they were adamant, and we had to use all legal means to ensure that the Honorable Jay Banda is taken to Maina Soko Medical Center, where it is more secure and where it's currently receiving treatment at the moment.
So, Ray, MP Banda, he said that he was dumped where you found him by unknown individuals. Are the police also investigating that side of his story?
Yes, of course, as police, we have intensified investigation into this matter. And we have actually made an appeal to the public to remain calm and refrain from speculating unverified information, because we as police are committed to uncovering the truth behind this incident and ensuring that all responsible persons or those that could be responsible behind this are held accountable.
Ray Hamuga is the Zambian police spokesperson. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 28th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. United Nations agencies say the humanitarian situation for an estimated 800,000 people in the Sudanese city of El Fasher and surrounding areas is rapidly deteriorating as fighting escalates between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Since clashes between Sudan's warring parties erupted 2 weeks ago near the city of El Fasher, the United Nations reports an estimated 85 civilians have been killed and at least 700 wounded. The International Organization for Migration says more than 1,250 people have been displaced this week alone from the city in Darfur, but also says that likely is an undercount. The UN Refugee Agency reports around 600 people a day are fleeing Darfur for safety across the border into Chad's Adre region. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler says it is likely many more would flee if they could, if not for the challenges to seeking refuge in Chad.
They are not able to do that because of the fighting or because they are being prevented by armed actors to travel. We also have received very worrying reports that some people who intended to either go to El Fasher from the surrounding countryside or cross into Chad have been killed.
Spindler says the situation in Chad, which is the epicenter of the Sudanese refugee crisis, is very worrying as well. He says Chad, an impoverished country, is overwhelmed by the burgeoning refugee population as it copes with more than 600,000 Sudanese refugees. In the past month, the UN says nearly 19,000 new arrivals have registered in Chad. At the same time, he says the UNHCR and other UN agencies are severely underfunded and unable to provide the refugees with the humanitarian support they need. He says conditions in refugee camps in the country are deteriorating, especially in Adre, just across the Sudan border.
The camps there are severely congested, and that's why UNHCR has identified a new site in Dugui where we would like to evacuate or to transfer these refugees who are in Adre, very close also to the border, to this new site where conditions are better and where it will be easier for us to provide assistance to them.
Spindler says the UNHCR and its partners are racing against time to open the new site before the rainy season, which has just begun, makes roads impassable. He says people must be moved as soon as possible to the camp where they will be safe, and it will be easier to provide the aid they need. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The younger brother of Burkina Faso's late head of state, Thomas Sankara, says the country is not ready for elections in the current environment. Paul Sankara's comment comes after Burkina Faso's military ruler, Captain Ibrahim Traoré, announced this Saturday that the military will stay in power for 5 more years. following consultations with civil society and transitional lawmakers. Paul Sankara denies his position is favoring security over democracy. He tells me that while the country has made some progress, it is not enough to hold election at this time.
The first indisputable point is that the situation is such that we cannot talk about election in this time. With this environment, we cannot. This is something that, including the political parties, most of them, if not all of them, they would agree with that point. The second negative thing is since the inception of the government, MPP2, it looks like they're trying to slide from the main reason why they claim to take the power about 2 years from now to maneuver and go through the political arena, traditional, classical political activities. Yes, you can talk about and take action for development, social, political, industrial development issues, correct. But excluding the political party in the game is not a good thing. That's my view in this first point.
But Paul, similar things seem to be happening in Mali. If I understand what you are saying, the people of Burkina Faso are choosing security over democracy. Is that correct?
No, you cannot make this opposed security and democracy. See what I'm saying? That, democracy needs security, peace. And peace and development mean security. This is the second reason, the way you phrase it, you gave me a supplement point, supporting point of my previous statement. That's why you need everybody to come and put on the table the reality. Today, we cannot organize elections in Burkina Faso. That's for sure. Unless we do it in just geographical part of the Burkina, but not the whole Burkina Faso. But let's have a roadmap, I'm sorry. Just to say, okay, civil society movement, militaries, lawyers, political parties, etc., etc. What can we do? This is the reality. Such and such places like the western part of Burkina Faso, the northern part, and the east, they have made some success, but it's not still quite before 2015, year of the beginning of terrorist attacks. We have made a progress, but it's still not enough to organize elections. So I'm not opposing democracy and security issues.
How do you think the military junta is doing? Because first, when they came to power, it seemed to some of us that they were trying to mimic your late iconic brother. How do you think they are doing so far?
Trying to mimic 4 years of revolution, it's not just the quote-unquote the folkloric aspect. How can I say that? Not in the form, but the content. The main difference is that before getting into power, Manly Thomas worked with the trade union, the youth, political party, even if when he was in training in different countries, the little time that he used to have, nights, weekends with those who were in France studying, you know, finishing their PhD. And so it's a background experience, political consciousness, a work done before getting into power in August 4th, 1983.
Paul Sankara is the younger brother of the late Burkina Faso head of state, Thomas Sankara. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. The French news agency AFP reports that gunmen attacked a remote village in central Nigeria, killing 8 people and kidnapping about 150 more in the country's latest mass abduction. Large-scale kidnappings for ransom are common in Nigeria's northwest and central states, where heavily armed gangs, known locally as bandits, often target remote villages. Local government chairman Aminu Najuma says attackers on motorbikes stormed Kuchi village in the Niger state on Friday night, where they killed 8 people and abducted about 150 villagers. A UN source gave the same figure for the number of kidnapped, while Nigerian state rescue agency SEMA said more than 100 were abducted. Boko Haram and rival jihadist group Islamic State West Africa Province, ISWAP, also regularly carry out abductions in northwest Nigeria. Chad's new Prime Minister, Halimaya Halina, announced his first government on Monday, marking an end to 3 years of military rule in the desert nation. According to the French news agency AFP, senior ministers, mostly allies of President Mahamat Idriss Deby Itno, were kept in the cabinet. The former ambassador to China was appointed on Thursday, just before junta leader Deby, an army general, was sworn in as president after an election victory contested by the opposition. Halina's predecessor, Success Masra, resigned last Wednesday after his defeat in the presidential election. The Economist had only been in office for 4 months. U.S. presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump are both campaigning for the support of black voters. VOA correspondent Cass Stearns looks at how the presidential campaigns are targeting African Americans.
Donald Trump told voters in New York that all Americans will benefit if he's elected.
It doesn't matter whether you're black or brown or white or whatever the hell color you are. It doesn't matter. We are all Americans, and we're going to pull together as Americans.
Joe Biden told civil rights leaders in Michigan that all Americans are represented in his cabinet.
We have more African Americans. We have more women. We have more minorities in our administration than any other administration in all of history. That's why we're doing so damn well.
Trump and Biden are both campaigning for the support of black voters in an election where that may make the difference in swing states that could decide the outcome. Pew Research data shows the top electoral issues for black Americans in 2024 are improving education and strengthening the economy. Trump says he'll tackle both.
We're going to bring success back to our schools. We're going to bring prosperity back to every neighborhood and every borough of the greatest city in our land.
The Biden campaign's targeting black voters with this ad about Trump in New York.
Of course I hate these people.
Donald Trump disrespecting black folk is nothing new. He was sued for refusing to rent his apartments to black families and called for the execution of 5 innocent black and brown teenagers.
Biden says Trump is a vengeful candidate whose election would hurt minorities.
Trump isn't running to lead America. He's running for revenge. But revenge is no way to lead a country. You can't build a future on revenge. You can't build better lives through revenge. That's why I'm running to lead America into the future.
Immigration is a central theme in Trump's campaign, one he tailored to minority voters in the South Bronx.
African Americans are getting slaughtered. Hispanic Americans are getting slaughtered. And these millions and millions of people that are coming into our country, the biggest impact and the biggest negative impact is against our black population and our Hispanic population, who are losing their jobs, losing their housing, losing everything they can lose.
Biden told black voters he needs them again to beat Trump.
You're the reason Donald Trump is the defeated former president. And you're the reason Donald Trump's going to be a loser again.
4 years ago, black voters chose Biden over Trump by 92%. As of last month, Pew Research data says that's down to 77% of black voters who would vote for or are leaning toward Biden, compared to 18% for Trump. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
And that's it for this Tuesday, May 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Botti in Washington, wishing you will have an amazing Tuesday.
Larry London. Border Crossings is the show. 1500 Universal is the time. So please tune in to hear your favorite music by request. And you can also tune in on Tuesdays for our special spotlight, Feature Artist of the Week. And this coming up Tuesday, May 28th, it's Riz and the Believers. You'll have a chance to hear that interview and hear their performance as well on Border Crossings from the Voice of America.
African warrior queen, the black princess, or other super heroes with afros are growing in popularity in comics. This week on Our Voices, we will dive into the comic world where creators contribute to the richness and diversity of the medium through their art in ways that resonate with all races and genders. Join the conversation on